You're listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental.
How are you feeling after that, Matt?
I feel a lot better than Bob.
Extra Time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Get lost.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
From New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental. From my apartment in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, Taquito, or General Sal, whichever one that is. Matt
General
Doyle.
General Sal.
Kaylin Carr. What's up, guys? How you doing? That was an early cat entry, I gotta say. Among the, you know, the shows we've done in quarantine slash whatever it is that this world is that we live in, normally the cats wait about 10-15 minutes to start coming in.
Yeah.
What's going on today?
I don't know. Well, first of all, we're recording a little bit later. Second of all, she has changed her schedule up a little bit. She's an old lady and she's finicky and she needs to have lap time at around noon or 12:30. She gets lap time. That's how it works in this house. She has us trained. We are her monkeys. She is not our kitty.
All right. Well, on that note,
everybody say hi to General Sal.
Hello, General Sal. Oh, how you doing? Now everybody's turned off the podcast and been like, what are these guys? What is wrong with them? We have a lot to talk about today. Tom Bogert, Tommy Scoop's going to drop by. Big news on DeAndre Yedlin, Reggie Cannon, Weston McKennie, and solidarity payments. He'll walk us through all that. Chris Aduyachim will also be here. It's almost over, but you can still use the hashtag Kick Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. Thank you to Continental Tire for being such a driver on this and also, of course, supporting Extra Time. Over the years, you can use the hashtag Kick Childhood Cancer. That's $25. I assume at this point that we've fully funded the $50,000 of the Children's Oncology Group. If we haven't, we have failed. So go toss a couple tweets in there, but more importantly, go read up on this. Understand how you can help in a bigger way than just once a month. We'll talk to Chris Aduyachim, though, about his battle. If you missed it, he had a very public battle with cancer that he beat and has now moved on. He's made 4 starts this year for DC, played 9 games, almost career highs for him. So we'll congratulate him on that, get him the story. Before we get to the instant content of Sunday night, which is basically the Philadelphia Union doing Fortnite celebrations in Gonzalo Higuain's face after he skied a PK, I just want to remind everyone that COVID does still exist. Sometimes it feels like it can fly right past you. Sometimes it feels like we've been in this prolonged nightmare and you're almost like, you know, our emotions and our mental side of this is sort of dulled to the danger. But there was a game postponed this week in Colorado, sporting Kansas City for some positive tests on Colorado's side. And then Nick Haglund came out after FC Cincinnati reported that they had a positive test and said, hey, it's me. So I encourage you to go read Nick Haglund's post on Twitter to do what you have to do. Wash your hands, wear your mask, socially distance, be safe. I won't lecture you. You don't need that. None of us do, but we all know what's at stake here. Now let's get to the fun stuff. Gonzalo Higuain got trolled in his first MLS game after missing a PK in the driving rain. And then he pulled out the very Italian hand gestures and had a little back and forth, I'm sure, in Spanish with Martinez of the Union. I mean, Jakob Glesnes was practically dancing in the box and then like kind of like kidney punching him in the back. It's so bizarre. What happened here?
I love that for a second we talked like we weren't going to open the show with this. Like we were like, oh, what should we go through? You know, Toronto had a good game. It's like, yeah, let's go for it.
We are who we are. What did you think of this, though, Kaylin? Because we had some tweets come in. Dave Durr tweeted, and those that you don't recognize that name, MLS head coach in the early days, media guy for a long time. He tweeted basically they didn't like the reaction of the Union players after the miss. He said maybe the emotions got to him, but it, quote, wasn't right. I mean, it did feel over the top. You don't normally see this when a player misses a PK. What did you think as a player watching the moment?
Loved it. Loved it. Loved every second of it. It was amazing. I mean, you see Martinez in his grill, Mark McKenzie, the whole squad just like circling him. And he was like, it was like something out of a weird dream to see Higuain in a new kit. You're still kind of getting used to him doing, you know, being in MLS in the rain in Chester, no fans, just like misskying a penalty. He almost scored a bike earlier in the match. It was wild. And then you see these guys getting in each other's faces. And I mean, Higuain didn't back down. He like jumped. He was ready to go, which to me meant that there was definitely some conversations happening leading up to this moment, and that it wasn't just like, hey, these guys were, I don't know, hyped that he missed the penalty. There was a conversation happening, and I think there was some physicality happening on the other side of the pitch as well. And so, this was going back and forth, and I was like, hey, it felt awesome to see, because I mean, I like this Philly team anyways, but seeing the personality and then seeing him kind of get in their face too. I don't know. I think we need stuff like this in MLS.
Yeah.
I want to know more. I don't understand like what happened, but I want to know more.
We need to know more. Everybody should have been asked about this after the match. They should have been asking Gonzalo Higuain about this. Every Union player should have been asked about this. What happened? What was being said? Why did you guys do this? Because this is the moment that people are talking about. Look, it was a big win for the Union, and we'll dig in with that. But if you go, I mean, and look, I don't want to overstate, like, social media doesn't matter. It's the fake world. But an hour after this, 1.5 million people had seen this. Like, this is, people want to talk about these things because it's emotional, because it's visceral, because it has an incredible visual aspect to it. I thought, where are his teammates? Because Gonzalo Higuain is up in there by himself, surrounded by Union players, again, throwing the very Italian hand gestures, yelling in Martinez's face, getting jacked up. And I don't see any Inter Miami players wading in there, pushing around, getting him some space, whereas the entire Union team is there. To me, that says a little something about where both are at. But yeah. I loved it. I loved it, Doyle. And Higuain probably had reason to be frustrated. I mean, he put this thing, if it was on the other side, it would have been in the river. Like, that banged into the luxury suites up there in Chester.
It was a really bad penalty kick, but we've seen a lot of really bad penalty kicks from Higuain's in MLS. So, you know, like older brother, like younger brother.
Whoa. Pipa's got a couple chips. He's got some
Panenkas.
Pipa, other than Maxi Morales.
Atlanta, I think.
Other than Maxi Morales, Pipa is the worst penalty kick taker in MLS. History.
This feels okay. Like a Kai Kamara setup here. He's a plant. Doyle's a plant for Kai.
Well, I was definitely Team Kai at that moment for sure, 100%. It was like Pipa played, or Pipita, Gonzalo Higuain played really well. He filled a lot of the gaps. He probably deserved a goal. You could see his quality. This moment, you could also see the hilarity of this sport of ours. And like you, I loved it. It got me thinking about, like, if this was the NBA and guys were drawn at each other like this, it would be A1 above the fold on everything that covers the NBA. But the bigger picture for me is always like, okay, so what about the team? And by basically every measure, Miami FC have been, Inter Miami have been worse than what I expected heading into this season. And over the past month, as they've added guys like Leandro Gonzalez Pires and Blas Matuidi, and now Gonzalo Higuain, those one goal losses, I thought they were going to turn into points. I thought they were going to turn into draws and they're going to turn into wins. Those one goal losses have now turned into multi-goal losses. Granted, this was a tough week. They played a Red Bulls team that looks refreshed and reinvigorated with an interim head coach and a little more clarity in how they want to play. And then going to Philadelphia, who I think we all agree is one of the best teams in the league. But I like penalty kick or not, Miami wasn't going to win this game. They didn't look for a moment like they were going to win this game. They were lucky not to be down to 10 men within 4 minutes because Andres Reyes cannot play center back at this level yet. And he's like, once a game, he's given everybody, any attack or whatever they want. So it's like everything that I saw in terms of potential in this team, it's come up short. And now there's 9 games left and they are below the playoff line. And granted, with this season the way it is, any 3-game winning streak and like it all turns around. You just don't see the spark of something sort of coalescing and coming together with this team. And I'm not saying hit the panic button, but Diego Alonso's got a lot of stuff to figure out in terms of how they're playing and how they can go forward. And so far, he hasn't taken any steps in actually doing that.
But I never would have expected Miami to go up to Chester and come away with really anything from that match. I mean, I thought if there's anything, Higuain gave them a little bit or a lot more as far as some personality, and had a couple good other chances as well, where he's, you know, you can see the quality that he has. Of course, everybody knows that. And that was sorely missed. So I don't think it's going to show in a match against Philly necessarily. But I saw enough there from him to say, okay, well, maybe if it's a different, some of these other matches where there was the 0-0 draws against Nashville, or it was, you know, playing against Atlanta, or some of the other matches that they've been tight in, even Orlando, that would be, I could see that starting to flip a little bit and seeing a path forward with Higuain in the side. But I think the expectations are just that, oh yeah, you're going to make a couple big name signings. You're going to get Blaise Matuidi. You're going to get Higuain, and suddenly it's going to be the old Atlanta United or LAFC.
No, I'm not even saying that. I'm just saying competent, right? And the first, look at the first goal that they gave up to the Union. They took a throw in. If you go and rewatch that highlight, the Union press a throw in where Miami's setup was so disjointed. Like you absolutely have to press that moment. And Miami just invites it forward. They lose a 50-50 ball with Pizarro, like barely, like basically not even contesting it. And then it's three passes. Fontana strolls into the box and roofs it. Like this is the type of play that you say, okay, it's March. You know, these types of things happen early in the season. It's not early in the season anymore. Season's more than half done for Inter Miami, and they're still giving up these easily defendable. Like, you cannot give up a goal within 6 seconds of taking a throw in your own half. That is something that is wrong, and that is something that Gonzalez Perez and Matuidi were supposed to fix. And it's actually getting worse for Miami right now, and the fans are grumbling about Diego Alonso. It's 2020, so any of that is kind of unfair, but also it's kind of warranted because they haven't taken a step forward at any point this year.
Yeah, it was supposed to be the buildup, right? And both they and Nashville were on that sort of same trajectory, and then it was a double down once COVID hit because all of a sudden circumstances were just insane. And it's weird to think and surprising to think and look at Nashville and say, actually, their trajectory and their progress looks more linear and more, I'm going to just say positive, than Nashville does despite the lack of star power. Now, I do think Gonzalo Higuain changes a lot for Inter Miami. You can see the moments where he drops in. You can see the times where he holds the ball up and brings in wingers into play. You can see those moments in the box where he beats like three guys, gets his head up, finds Lewis Morgan, and Morgan misses, and all of a sudden here come those Italian hand gestures again. Like, he had the moments. He can create space for his shot better than anybody in this league, in my opinion. Like, in a packed-in situation with a defender in front of him, his little feints, his shifts, his ability to hit it with both feet, with power and with precision. I mean, it's going to be incredible. But I just don't think that they've built from anything, to what you said, Doyle. There was supposed to be a foundation. Like, what is the foundation? I know they made a lot of changes. LGB coming in, Matuidi, like, straight up the spine. But you would have thought that Diego Alonso would have used those moments as level ups. And right now, they sort of feel like they're kind of hanging in the precipice. They're hanging in the balance. And more often than not, they're falling off. Now, the Red Bulls also got a huge win this weekend. So maybe this league is just crazy and unpredictable and nothing matters. And trying to predict and trying to build and trying to do these things is just for naught, because it's an every night thing. Are your guys motivated? Are they healthy? What's the weather like? Who are you playing against? What lineup's available to you? Like, maybe trying to evaluate teams in collective senses outside the top four is just a fool's errand. Because then you have things like San Jose beating LA in LA that you never would have expected and probably shouldn't have expected. So I definitely think Diego Alonso has some work to do. I definitely don't think this is the Inter Miami team that we expected. I definitely think Gonzalo Higuain will make things better. How much better? That's the, like, what, $7, $8 million question, right?
I'll give him a couple more weeks. Give him a couple weeks.
I am. No. Gonzalo Higuain's not the problem. There's no way. This dude's quality. Like, you watch this game.
Oh, yeah.
You see it immediately.
But even just to see how it gels. Like, even just to see how it gels.
But that's the thing. Do they have a couple more weeks? Because by if we go a couple more weeks and then suddenly there's only five games left in the season.
Yeah, but what, you got to get into the 10th spot? I mean,
that's fair.
You just got to get somewhere in and around it, which is hard not to be. I mean, you have to be pretty bad to stay outside it, and they put themselves in a huge hole to begin the season. But I think still you're hoping that this is a longer term project. If they could get into a playoff position at all and get, then yeah, you give yourself a chance with a guy like Higuain on the side.
But, let me just make one last point. They have two wins over Atlanta. Over the rest of the season, they only have one win. That's it. Against any team not Atlanta, they have one win on the season. It's got to happen soon for Miami, or it's not happening in 2020.
I think the thing that I would be most disappointed about or frustrated by, if I was an Inter Miami fan, would be Julian Carranza and Matheus Pellegrini not really showing. I mean, there was a flash from Carranza. There was a flash or two from Pellegrini. But those are big money transfers and guys that were supposed to be, if not big time difference makers right now, middle of the season, end of the season, into 2021. And right now, you're not really seeing that return. We did not talk about Philly in our top two teams in the league, in the Eastern Conference even, really on Thursday. We basically crowned the crew in Toronto. We'll get to that in a second. But we spent all this time ripping apart Inter Miami, and we only gave a smidgen to the Union, who, as you said, Kalen, just never in doubt. Do they have a shout in that top two teams in the league, let alone the East? Are they in that echelon, or is there still one just above the Union that they've yet to push into, Doyle? What do you think?
I think that the Union are right there with Columbus. I have the same questions about both those teams, which is, are their top-level guys good enough? Because we all know you get to the playoffs, and it's Toronto, and it's Seattle, and you know what the top level guys on those teams for the regular season. I don't think this is a big win for the Union. I think this is a story of, like, if they are as good as the numbers say they are and as good as they've been playing, this is a type of game that you should win. They did it. Next game.
That's it.
Like, I mean, it's cool.
That's an announcement that they are making massive progress as a club. Yeah.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it should surprise no one. If you look at what they've done year over year with Jim Curtin, they have improved every single year. The big question coming into this year was, can they be as good if El Seno drops off? Well, El Seno had a goal in this one, but he has dropped off, and yet they're better than last year. And this is all great news for the Union, but at the end of the year in the playoffs, the question is going to be, are the Union's best guys good enough to do what Raul Ruiz Diaz and Jozy Altidore do in the playoffs basically every single year?
Yeah. I've said this a while, but it feels like it's either Sergio Santos who's on or Shabilko's on, and it's one or the other, and they go in spurts. Yep. And Sergio Santos did that in the playoffs last year. If they get hot at the right time, you look at a guy like Sergio Santos and you're like, yeah, he fully fits that bill as a top striker in this league. And same with Shabilko as well. But I think the depth has been I always thought they were a top three team in the East leading into the season. And even throughout, I mean, I picked them at the MLS Cup tournament. I think this year they're uniquely positioned for a 2020 because they have depth, they have youth, and they have a lot of pieces that they've even found out that they've had more. Like, Brendan Aaronson has taken a step forward, but Fontana has emerged. Real, Mark McKenzie, I think, has taken a step forward this year. So there's basically, their young players have gotten better and become central parts of the team. They always have Bedoya, I mentioned El Seno. I think they're right around there. I think it's fair to question, are those two strikers the guys that can be top goal scorers, or can they be killers like a Rui Diaz, or will they let one of those chances miss? And that's the one that is the one that holds them back.
I guess we'll segue. I'm going to segue as we watch this.
Segue.
And I guess that's the question that we have to have for Columbus as well. Because with Philadelphia and Columbus, do they have that gear that Toronto hit in the second half of that 3-1 win in Hartford on Sunday? Because Columbus was a better team in the first half of the game, and I thought Caleb Porter was right in his post-game comments. Like, yeah, they had a bad half, but a big part in the second half. But in the second half of that game, Toronto was like, well, let's kick this into fourth gear and see what happens. And then there was only one team on the field. And I'm like, Toronto can do that. Seattle can do that. LAFC, I thought last year could do that. I'm not convinced that Philly or Columbus can do that. And when Toronto play like they played on Sunday night, they're hands down the best team in the Eastern Conference.
So Sean, he's a Columbus Crew fan writing from San Jose, basically asked what happened in that second half. To you, was it just that simple, that different gear, that like ramp it up, see what happens? Was it just the individualism of like a Richie Larea? Is it just Alejandro Pozuelo is better than everybody else? And when he starts feeling a rhythm and starts running it in the final third, Toronto FC are almost impossible to stop. Was it the lack of Darlington Nagbe to sort of settle the game down? Like, what is it that changed?
I think it's a little bit of all of that. There was a tactical shift in terms of flipping. Pablo Piatti had played on the left side in the first half. They played him on the right side in the second half and had him pinch in, which effectively cleared out the entire touchline for Larea to get forward. And then Larea never even got back to defend. They were having Jonathan Osorio, who is playing defensive midfield now, when Toronto needed to defend that right flank or to even build from that right flank, it was Osorio dropping deep into the right. So Osorio playing almost like a hybrid right back in order to overload that, you know, the right flank up and allow Larea to go at literally the entire team at one point. And Larea is just a devastating attacking threat. And when you have that coming in from right fullback, and you have the league MVP and Alejandro Pozuelo was the 10, and you have Pablo Piatti, he's not great, but he knows how to play around the box as your strong side winger. And then you have Jozy Altidore and Ayo Akinola as your forwards. Like this, they have a gear and they know how to find it that other teams in the Eastern Conference just can't match. And I think the Crew are a really good team and they were without Nagbe and they, you know, have a couple injuries they're trying to deal with. But this was just, it was a really impressive half of soccer from Toronto.
What did this win by Toronto tell you, Kayla? Like, does this 90 minutes say, okay, the Reds are this much above Columbus? Because remember, Toronto's dealing with, and so are Montreal and Vancouver, so much more, I think, than teams in the U.S. Like the travel, the quarantine, you go back home, you can't train, you can't be around the team, then you're back at Rentschler Field, you're playing your home games in a weird spot. Like, how much did this 90 minutes really tell you about either of these teams?
Well, look, I think Columbus has been the best team in MLS so far this year, which is why I had so much intrigue leading up to this match. But the two things that I said leading up to this were, one, the best player on the pitch is still Pozuelo. And we talked about that before as far as like what that means for the Union and how that compares to some other sides, but how important your best player can be. And I thought that was pretty clear here. And then the other thing is the mental side, the psychological side. And Toronto FC are the defending Eastern Conference champions. And if you're going to go to MLS Cup, it's going to be through Toronto still. And that's every year. And we keep saying, all right, well, how does Seattle and how does Toronto continue to do this? And a part of it is when this team is locked in, when they're dialed in mentally, and have any semblance of health, even if they don't have it, they're still able to do it. And yes, I think Doyle makes a good point, and Fanny seems to always be able to pull the right strings and get contributions from different players. But there's a psychological aspect that I think Toronto has over pretty much any other team in the Eastern Conference right now, and that's still the bar for me. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, it was impressive to see when this team is dialed in how tough they are to beat.
One name, I think you already said yours, Doyle, for MVP, mm-hmm. Kalen. If you had to make your vote right now, is it Alejandro Pozuelo or would you take the field?
I didn't do my prep for this. I would say probably Pozuelo, but how far up is Rui Diaz right now? Because he's another name that...
But that's the thing with the Sounders, right?
Yeah, that's the problem.
It could be Ladero, be Morris, you know, like they split the vote. Whereas with Toronto, like as great as a lot of these guys can be, this is Pozuelo's team now. and he's playing like it every week, and he's playing with it on both sides of the ball, which is the big difference from last year. When he came to MLS last year, it was mid-March. He had basically already played a full season in Belgium, and he was just running on fumes, and he was still a best 11 player. This year, he got a ton of rest like everybody else in the league, and he's just... he's playing at a higher level than anybody else in the league. And Toronto, it feels like they're just starting to pick up steam. If they get Josie healthy, he played 83 minutes in this one. If they get Josie healthy, if they're able to get Justin Morrow healthy, I thought having him back was a big story in this one. I mean, Toronto and Seattle again.
Oh, God. I mean,
I love it.
I mean, I like it, but I need a little bit. Even in this year, we couldn't get something random and crazy and stupid.
Well, there's plenty of time.
Yeah, we got producer Anders here, all caps in the chat over here. You love to see it. Giants of the league, massive. It's miserable to be around this man as the Sounders win. We'll talk about that one in just a second. But I want to dig in on Richie Larea because I was reading Ben Bear's column, I want to say middle of the week, and he was talking about Anton Tinnerholm and
Tinnerholm. It was Saturday night, Wavy.
It was Saturday night? Ugh. I have no idea what's happening. I don't know. But anyway, he wrote something I thought was interesting off this NYCFC 4-0 win against Cincinnati, that Anton Tinnerholm is MLS's best right back. And he kind of implied that it wasn't even really close. And then I started going through my depth charts mentally, and I was like, yeah, but Harrison Offal's in this league. And then I was thinking Richie Larea, and then he went and did that against the Crew and dribbled the whole team and Meg the keeper. And Huon's been great. And Roman Metaner is like best 11 at times. And Kelvin Leerdam, who I'm sure producing Anders is going to be in the chat telling me I forgot. And then you even go down to second tier and it's like Ray Gaddis and Brandon Bye and Aaron Herrera and Brian Reynolds and Julian Araujo. And
wait a minute. Brian Reynolds has like 4 games. Did you just stick him in there?
Hell yeah, I did. You better believe I stuck him in there. I'm riding that bandwagon TID. I mean, but who's the best right back in MLS? Is Ben Wright? Is it Anton Tinnerholm? Or does he have to go through Richie Larea?
Depends what you're looking for. I mean, Tinnerholm, I think, he can give you a lot going forward. We've seen him score nice goals. I think Larea gives you a little bit something different because he can play in a 4-back system, he can play in a 3-back system, he can play as a wide guy, he can play as a winger. And as far as the top end potential and these moments that you see from Larea, you're like, whoa, like he just jumps off the page. You're like, whoa, dude, the stop start, the start again, the stop again, the finish, the personality. I like his personality as well. He's a fighter and is down to scrap. And well, Tinnerholm's got a little bit of that too. but and then Leerdam is like a little bit more of like a steady force. I feel like he's very solid in possession. He can chip in with goals. He can move forward. He's a little bit more methodical at times, but can also play. He's versatile as well as far as the different formations he can play in. I think those are my top three. And Huon, I think, is up there, but it's a little bit more of a one kind of like, let's get up and down and just really just blaze.
I mean, that's Roman Metaner too, right? That's both of them.
Yeah, Metaner as well. Where I think some of these other guys can maybe tuck inside and then also overlap. So I don't know. There's some nice choices there.
I like
Larea as the top, as my top pick. I might take producer Anders will like this. I think if I were to like look through the entire list, I think the steady force of Leerdam for me is maybe what I would take him and the versatility as my pick.
Oh Lord.
Give me a name. Sorry. Producer Anders is basically running the show right now. He's loving it. He's loving this. Who are you taking, Doyle? Just give me a name.
On body of work, you have to take the Tinnerholm, but if I was picking a team right now, I would take Larea. He's 25. He just switched positions last year. Toronto rehabbed his career. Orlando City, after 3 years, threw him on the scrap pile. Only played him 500 minutes over 3 years. Toronto got him for free ahead of last year. He's already, 18 months later, we're talking about him as one of the best right backs in the league. Not just in the league, he's one of the best right backs in CONCACAF. It would not shock me at all if there were European offers for him at the end of this year. He's a little older than most of the guys we've seen get sold. He's 25, but that's not too old. And he is that level of a talent.
All right, let's talk about another high-end right back. They got sold to Europe out of MLS. All right, time now for an AT&T 5G call to the field. It's Tommy Scoops, Tommy Bogert. You can follow his work at MLSsoccer.com and, of course, on Twitter. If you're not following, you're missing a lot of nuggets coming down, including a big one the other day while I was at the park with my kid. I checked my phone, Tom, and I see DeAndre Yedlin could potentially be coming back to MLS in this window. Tell us the news. What's happening? What does it mean?
What's going on, fellas? Thanks for having me. Hope your day at the park was good and that didn't, push things away for you too much.
Beautiful day.
But yeah, so DeAndre Yedlin is at least in discussions with two MLS teams about, you know, a potential return to the league. And if you asked me a couple days ago what the chances were that he came back this window, I would have said extremely unlikely. But the discussions right now would be around him being on a TAM deal, a max TAM deal, rather than a DP contract, which, again, I thought was extremely unlikely just based on how much of a pay cut he'd have to take from Newcastle. So I don't have any further info about who the teams are or how, you know, really serious the conversations are, but those conversations are genuinely happening. It's not just like I reported, you know, a month or two ago where it was essentially just kicking the tires and being like, hey, would he come for cheap and would Newcastle sell him for nothing? And it was like, maybe, I don't know. So like now that it's a genuine thing. And I don't know if I'd go as far to say that it's likely that he comes back this window, but it's at least within the realm of possibility. And it all hinges on whether or not Newcastle will let him go for free. And that's something that up until now, they've been pretty hard with no based on reporting out of Newcastle. So I guess we'll just see how this one unfolds.
I'm trying to figure out, what does the siren mean in this scenario? You know, we had the old radiator. We've had a lot of noises come through. As you're talking about Yedlin coming back to MLS, what does the siren signify? Kaylin, I mean, do you have a feeling here? I know it was outside your window. You have a sly smile.
Could you tell that? I tried to hit mute and see if I could get away with it. Yeah.
Almost did.
We had good city background noise. Good city.
I feel any time a Bogert tweet is going up, you just got to sound the alarms, man.
Exactly.
It's the sound my phone makes anytime Tommy hits a tweet. But no, so two things on this. Yedlin is in the final year of his deal, right? So he could, in theory, sign a pre-contract for next summer, and Newcastle doesn't lose it, but he doesn't care about losing him for free. That's one. Number two, you keep talking about how much he's on at Newcastle. How much is he on at Newcastle?
The way it was packaged to me is that it was at whatever his earnings would be after taxes, because obviously that's all that matters because to Yedlin, because that's what's actually hitting his account rather than just what the number is. But I was told it was like
taxes,
four and a half or 5 million or something like that, depending on what the percentages are. So
bless you, DeAndre.
And dropping all the way down to it'd be like what 1.53 or something like that. Like it's a steep drop, and it's that's why I was so surprised that this was even within the realm of possibility.
We will discuss after you get off where we would like to see DeAndre Yedlin go, but for right now, let's talk about Reggie Cannon. He did go, went to Boa Vista. We always wondered with this deal, what was Leal's involvement? What was the sell on? What's like the long play? Not just for Reggie, but also for FC Dallas. And then they came out and told you.
Yeah, so Dallas, I already thought it was a good deal as is. Like I know some people were a little bit underwhelmed that it was Boa Vista or that Barnsley were bidding first and that it wasn't, you know, a bigger club, let's say Leal. Turns out Leal, like as expected, are the driving force here. You know, Boa Vista had only previously paid, their transfer record was like 1 million before Reggie. So like everybody kind of knew that Leal was driving this, but Andres, Dallas's GM sporting director, Andres Anata, said that like the plan is Leal in a year. And he said that pretty matter of factly. So it's obviously true that Leal are very interested in him. And Dallas have a sell on percentage for his next deal. But an interesting wrinkle to that, you know, regular clause is something unique is that if he's sold from Boa Vista to Leal, Dallas can kind of push their sell on fee down the road. So they wouldn't take a cut of the deal from Boa Vista to Leal, but they'd still hold his percentage. And so the idea is that they're playing the long game that, okay, we think he's going to go to Leal soon, and then we think that Leal isn't even going to be the destination for him, that maybe in a couple more years, they Leal do the Leal thing where they're acquiring an appreciating asset and then selling them for a ton to like a even bigger European club. So the idea for Dallas is that they're content with what they have right now if they don't get a single dollar for him after this, but they still are going to hold a percentage if/when he goes to Leal.
What about Brendan Aaronson? Again, sound the alarm. Where's the sirens? Heard those sirens when I saw you tweeting. I hear confirming that something verbal is done, correct, between Salzburg and Aronson?
Yeah, so the agreement is there between Philly and Salzburg and between Aronson and Salzburg. Nothing's been drafted up or signed yet, so that's why I was kind of trying to make sure that it said verbal and that people don't think it's going to be announced tomorrow. You know, he still has to do his medical. All the paperwork needs to be drafted up and sent and everything, but the way it was described to me by multiple people was just like, it's done. Like, it's done. Like, kind of don't worry. So Aronson should be, barring, you know, something unforeseen, kind of getting in the way here, but he'll be a Salzburg player soonish. I don't know when it would be announced, but he would stay with Philly for the rest of the season and then go to Salzburg in January.
How does this work out to go back to the Reggie deal? I mean, we're talking about sell-on. We're talking about basically way stations for players in Europe. That would seem to be what Aronson would be for Salzburg. That's their business model. They buy players, they sell them. How does this work for the union throughout, or do you know?
This would be, you know, like a monumental deal for Philly. Like, I don't want to sound like I'm being hyperbolic, but this is their first academy player that they're selling abroad. Like, this kind of really puts it, like it's a big win for all the money that they put into the academy and their model and the trust that they've given Jim Curtin by keeping around, because he's just a very good coach and a very good developer of talent. And this is, you know, a plus in, this is why you bring in Ernst Tanner. And because he's starting to show, you know, he's found a couple guys on really good value, like Kai Wagner and Kasper Jabilko. And that was an important part of them hiring him. But it's also his background with Hoffenheim and Salzburg, where he finds young players, helps develop them, and then sells them for more. And that's how this is good. This wheel keeps on turning for Philly. If you're going to be a team that's not going to have the biggest budget, who's not going to have the biggest investment, then you need to win on the margins like this. And the academy and selling players like this is the biggest and best way to do it. And so if/when this deal happens, it's huge. It's going to be the first one. And again, it's proof of concept. It shows to the next kids, maybe Aronson's brother Paxton, that look, this is a great spot for your development and we're not going to hold you back. And even when it came to guys that they've traded within the league, like Derek Jones to Nashville, they didn't see a place for him in their team and they were able to send him to Nashville where he was going to have a better chance of playing. Austin Trusty, he kind of was unhappy after he got benched, wanted a new contract, didn't get one. And they're like, fine, we'll move you on to Colorado so we can let our next academy kid come in. So, you know, whether your end goal is to get to Europe, the Champions League and everything, which I'm sure all of those kids have, Philly's not going to, you know, block you either if you're a talented player who's, you know, maybe not good enough for either the Philly first team or to go to Europe. But, you know, it's really good. It just shows the wheels it's moving.
You know how we can tell that Tom's from New Jersey? Because he's pounding the hell out of that table. I mean, every time he makes a point, he's just beating it down.
What about that? Sounds bad because the old adage, when you have the facts, pound the facts. When you don't have the facts, you pound the table. So now I don't want to sound like I'm just talking greasy, just saying nothing.
Oh boy, let's talk Weston McKennie. So he's not maybe the ideal scenario for FC Dallas. They would have liked to have him in his first team, but he did make it to that Champions League point. But now it seems solidarity is coming back the other way. And that's sort of been a weird word for MLS fans for a lot of years, whether or not they were going to participate or get it with players, whether or not players were going to be positioned to have that trickle back down to the club. What happened with Weston and Dallas?
So, yeah, this is so huge that Dallas are going to receive solidarity payments for the transfer of Weston McKennie from Schalke to Juventus, because he obviously left the academy in 2016 and MLS didn't join this, you know, global, like the solidarity payment stuff that, again, is the norm across the globe, but now MLS are finally a part of it too. They didn't join that until 2019. So theoretically, they didn't have a claim to this. And what I was told is that it's not like Dallas or MLS like called and said, hey, would you mind doing the right thing here and giving us some money? Or, hey, would you mind, maybe could we do this? It was the other way around. Juventus contacted Dallas. Like, that's how this happened. Like, so it's not like Dallas or MLS went chasing this. And that's like a small side part to that is, I guess, Juventus doing the right thing. And that's multiple times in a row that they've been kind of in a good spot to MLS teams. Like, they let Matuidi and Higuain out of their contracts, essentially. They found a way to settle without, you know, getting too much in the way or getting in the way or whatever of them ending up at Miami. They were able to be free agents rather than, you know, transfer fees. And now with the McKennie deal, they sent a letter like, okay, hey, we're going to pay the payments or the solidarity or whatever it is. And Dallas are going to get a cut of a very small cut, but a cut nonetheless of the loan fee, which is reported to be $3.5 million. And if Juventus pick up the purchase option, which is reported to be like $21.5 million, they'll also get a percentage of that.
Does that set a precedent for other like say Gio Reyna or other players that may have left early?
I hope so, but no, because again, the stance there is that Dallas aren't, they're not pursuing it themselves. I think moving forward, it's going to be about the other clubs contacting the European clubs contacting the MLS clubs. But I don't know that for certain, but in this case it was. And I would assume, just again, because MLS didn't join this until 2019. So anything before that is really gray area.
All right, Tom, before I let you go, you're watching MLS, you're reporting, you're digging around. What's a nugget that stands out in your mind that you need to talk about? You need to get off your chest. Other than that APCFC crest, I need to get that shirt. Shout out to my guy, Sean Francis.
Yeah, so just one thing I was talking to people when Dallas signed Andres Recarte because I was kind of surprised, like, whoa, does this mean maybe there's something happening with Pomico forever? And I was like, no, we just think he's a good player. And then I talked to a scout who said, he's not just a good player. He might be like best 11 quality or like all-star quality. I was like, really? Like, why was he still in Colombia? Like, then you watch him play and it's like, holy crap, this dude is really, really good. And then I was asking around pretty much and it was a pretty bad job of reporting because my question was just like, why hasn't he went to Brazil or to Argentina or to Mexico or to the MLS before this? And it was pretty much that like his club were difficult in letting him go earlier in his career. Like Boca Juniors apparently wanted him at one stage. Jorge Sampaoli, the former Argentina manager, who is now on his second Brazilian club, wanted to bring him to both of the clubs that he's been at in Brazil. And this was kind of fueled in part by COVID that it was easier to let him go and easier for the club to get some money for him. But I was just like shrugging my shoulders, like, how has this guy not moved anywhere in his career at this point? So I don't know. I think that's interesting. And I'm a huge fan of his. And he's, you know, I think Doyle was the first person to say this, like probably the closest thing that this team has had to Mauro Diaz and by way of like play style since he left. So
no surprise, Doyle bringing up Mauro Diaz. But Recarte is a great player. You're a great reporter, Tom. Tell people how they can follow you. MLSsoccer.com for the written stuff. What's the Twitter, man?
Twitter at Tom Bogert.
All right, big thanks to Tommy Bogert, Tommy Scoops. Follow him on Twitter, MLSsoccer.com. We're having an interesting conversation kind of in the downtime here about whether we, Reggie Cannon, Richie Larea, the right back for the U.S. men's national team. What did you say, Kalen? Boy, it would just be fun if Richie Larea was our right back. Is that a good quote?
But we can't keep poaching all these, you know, Canadian players. We got to let Canada do their thing. We'll take Io, yeah.
they stole Jonathan David from us. Come on now.
Yeah, that's fair.
Brooklyn's own.
Brooklyn. By the way, we got some...
Sergio Dest is the right back for the men's national
team. We've got a little email about the Canadian 11 to play off of our U.S. 11. We'll get to that in just a second. Let's talk about the Western Conference really quickly. And come on, let's just talk about San Jose. I mean, I put the poll out because they're just getting waxed. They're just getting beat up and down the field for like 2 weeks straight, 7-1, 6-1, could have been more. And I'm like, all right, what do people think? How many goals are LAFC going to drop on them after LAFC dropped 4 in 14 minutes against the Whitecaps? And then, of course, they come out and win and only allow one goal and go wild with the celebration. Jackson Yule, he's only 23, with the backheel goal. I mean, when it's good for San Jose, it looks good, man. And like, it feels good more. It feels like, you know, I love the quote afterwards is like, we put our soul into this one, or like our souls are one or something crazy like
that. It feels like they follow like a script where they're like, all right, this is going to be the craziest win in extra time ever. Or we're just going to, I don't know.
Like, we're just going to roll over. I mean, their celebrations are that, like, the way that they celebrated that win against LAFC, rightfully so, based on what they've been through. But it was like, I don't know, it was like an exorcism. They're like, oh, the devil's out of us. We got this done. I mean, but how did they do it? Why did they do it? Doyle, what is wrong with this league? Why can't we predict anything? I love it and I hate it and I'm confused by it.
I think at this point we can predict that Brian Rodriguez is not going to finish his chances, because this should have been 3 or 4 nil to LAFC by the middle of the second half. And he you can see when he plays, he has so much talent. He gets into great spots. He, has a really good touch at times. And then for whatever reason, he gets in the 18 and he shoots and he looks like me. For like great goal scorers, everything seems to slow down and they hit the like nice and square and they find that like, it just looks like it's in rhythm. Brian Rodriguez gets into those spots and everything speeds up. And his touch deserts him, and he scuffs his shots, and he falls down while he's trying to
you know, to shoot the ball. It's wild to see such a talented player become such a liability. And it is at this point, you have to say that as talented as he is a liability for that team. Because the way they play, the wingers are supposed to get into good goal-scoring spots and to finish those kill patterns. And obviously, Rossi's doing it on one side. They are getting more out of Bradley Wright Phillips than anybody thought that they were going to get out of Bradley Wright Phillips this year. Rodriguez is not holding up his end of the bargain. All the good chances, bar one, for LAFC last night fell to Brian Rodriguez. And he could not finish them, and that left the door open. And we've seen time and again with LAFC this year, if the attackers leave the door open, the defenders are just going to invite the other team right on in. You know, Diego Palacios not winning, not even putting in really a challenge on Espinoza on that, on the game winner. Eddie Segura getting worked by a 16-year-old in the corner. And Andy Nahar just standing there in the six-yard box, literally standing upright, watching the play unfold and not making a move to the near post to maybe get a body in front of Ewell. Like, this is a TAM guy. This is a guy that they paid through the nose to get to the number one allocation spot. He did not have tired legs. He was on for the last 6 minutes of the game. Look, San Jose deserve a lot of credit for fighting back and getting the win after multiple 5-goal defeats. But to me, this was more about LAFC being the same old disastrous and just like unreliable defense that we've seen from LAFC all year. And it's not an aberration at this point. This is just who they are.
Maybe the shot of the night comes from whichever cameraman was on the sideline that trained his camera on Bob Bradley, and right behind Bob Bradley is the San Jose celebrations in stoppage time. I mean, that was like the moment of this match. Just a weird, crazy year for LAFC. I think they'll get a lot of the benefit of the doubt because they haven't had Carlos Vela, but there are some other things at play here. This is not the juggernaut that we, as so many people wrote in to tell us, lavished praise on all the time last year. It's a completely different situation. Now, the Sounders...
Let me just make a real quick point. So... because right back has been such an issue for them, they have had to move Latif Blessing to right back. Mm-hmm. And Latif Blessing is like a below average MLS right back. You saw him pushed up too far on the Shea Salinas goal, the late equalizer.
The legend.
The legend himself. But also, by taking Latif Blessing out of central midfield, they are no longer a particularly good pressing team anymore. So the things that defined LAFC last year are gone, and they're still trying to work their way through that, and they haven't been able to do it and grind out results with any sort of consistency. They're either dropping six on you if you're Vancouver, or they're taking terrible losses like this, and they have to address that back line still, which is what we all said this time. Well, not even this time. At the end of last year, when they traded Walker Zimmerman and when they said, you know, Steven Betisher, thanks, but no thanks. We all said, well, they must have some big backline moves incoming. Well, they've tried to make one in Nahar. Hasn't worked. They haven't made the other in central defense, and they're on the clock like everybody else. They're on the clock, and it doesn't look like it's getting better.
Meanwhile, Kaylin, the Sounders are getting the gang back together. Roman Torres is back per Paul Tenorio. Brad Smith is back. I mean, everybody's coming back to a team that's already, in my opinion, not even influenced by producer Anders, top of the Western Conference, right there with Toronto FC at the top. I mean, they just rolled over the LA Galaxy. It felt easy. It looked easy. It was like a no-sweat, effortless sort of win for them. What did you learn from this game? Whether it's about the Sounders, maybe nothing, or about the Galaxy, who still cannot do jack with Chicharito on the field.
Yeah, well, I mean, both of those things I think we kind of knew going into the match. So I wasn't really surprised by the outcome. I would say by these moves, it tells me that the Sounders organization understands that they are still in the middle of an amazing passage and an amazing run and have a chance to win trophies. And that the one thing that they may be missing a little bit is some of the experience in the back line. And we just talked about LAFC and how some of those small changes have really disrupted things. And that started to show some cracks in the Sounders throughout the season. And I'm not saying Roman Torres is going to come back and start every match, but similar to the way we've seen in you know, tough decisions in the playoffs. Who are you going to give a game to? You want to give Roman Torres the call in those situations. And Brad Smith is another guy as well, where it's not so much that, you know, Nuhu can't do the job or that, you know, you need to unlock Jordan Morris in any way. It's more just for that defensive solidity, that trust and understanding where they are as an organization, where they are like, we are right here on top of another, looking forward on top of another title. And if we make a couple small changes where we bring Roman back and really have to give up pretty much nothing to get him in both of these cases. So it's just, you know how they're going to fit in the locker room. Welcome home. And when it comes down to some of these big matches, be nice to look down the bench and be able to call one of those names.
Jordan Morris is pretty reliable at this point. And if you give him space in behind, he's going to just destroy you. And that happened repeatedly in this match. I mean, Christian Roldan is running in behind this Galaxy back line unimpeded and chipping Bingham and making it look exceedingly easy. Exceedingly easy. Doyle, what is the deal with the Galaxy right now? Is it as simple, is it as binary as Chicharito on the field, Chicharito off the field? Chicharito can't put pressure on Joao Paulo in midfield with his head up with the entire field to look at. Like, he's not doing his job in the box, but this feels much bigger to me.
So I think that the Galaxy were out of gas. And if you look at the way these two teams have rotated their squads, like, you got to give Brian Schmetzer a ton of credit because he plays the same old 4-2-3-1 every single game. He buys rest for these guys whenever he can, you know, whether it's Alex Roldan coming in and getting time at right back or Morris only playing 55 minutes one game so that he's fresh to go 75 the next game. He has done so well with that. Guillermo Barros-Skelotto has not done that almost at all. I think he's rotated his squad less than almost anybody in the league. And so you have a midfield in particular that was absolutely out of gas. And when you have a midfield that's out of gas, you can't get pressure to the ball. And if you can't get pressure to the ball and you're playing against Nico Ladero and you're playing a high line, Jordan Morris is running on that line, you are going to give up multiple breakaways. So it's like this confluence of breakdowns. It's really a cascade of breakdowns in terms of personnel management and tactical approach, and then just not having the wherewithal to handle the stresses of a compressed season. In attack, it seems to me like they're trying to play through Chicharito too much. It feels like Christian Pavone has less room to work and is getting less of the ball in dangerous situations. But I mean, I don't even know who that, like, to me, that's another one that would go on Skelotto if anyone, but I can't, you know, at this point, the Galaxy fans are throwing their hands up. I'm throwing my hands up as well.
We are not going to belabor this one. And we have some great emails about the Red Bulls, but I kind of want to save those for Charlie, because he came on and, like, Gerhard Struber, he was like, nah, this guy's not good enough for the Rebels. Nah, this is not a sign of ambition. So I'm going to save one for them on Thursday. Dave and Charlie will be back for that. It's the holiday, so Dave is gone. But I do want to read this and just get your guys' quick thoughts. And then we'll talk to Chris Aduyatsum about his battle with cancer and about what Kick Childhood Cancer Month means to him. This is from Ricky in Brooklyn. Shout out to Ricky. Says he's been listening for a while now, loves the show, but this is his first email. Said, during Thursday's episode, in response to reports about Gerhard Struber becoming the next head coach of the Red Bulls, Charlie said, quote, that's very underwhelming if I'm a Red Bulls fan, and quote, how is this putting you in a conversation of a team that has ambition? So first of all, Ricky says, I am a Red Bulls fan, and I'm not underwhelmed to find out that my favorite team is chasing an up-and-coming manager who, according to a report in The Athletic, shout out to The Athletic, is highly sought after and theoretically could be coached in the Premier League next season. According to reports today, by the way, and if you didn't see this, now we're telling you, Red Bull are going to put together maybe 2 million euros to sign the buyout clause or to activate the buyout clause. What other investments, says Ricky, has MLS teams made in getting that kind of coach? I think that's ambition, he says. And Charlie said, I've never heard of the guy I'll reserve judgment, but I guess that kind of take doesn't make for a good podcast. Shout out to Dave for hitting the nail on the head. It's about getting a coach that fits and understands the system, not just a quote sexy name. Then again, Goss actually knows what he's talking about when it comes to the Red Bulls. Ricky in Brooklyn bringing the heat. Thank you, Ricky. I wanted to save that for Charlie, but we'll have to just email it to him or text it to him and just see how he reacts. I'm sure he'll come in on Thursday. Super hot. But the Red Bulls with a big win against Montreal, who are going through it as far as travel and COVID concerns and everything else. Physically, like they don't have their top goal scorer. They don't have their best midfielder in this game. They get worked off the pitch 4-1. Let's focus more on Struber, though, Doyle. When you see these rumors, when you see that 2 million euros, when you think about what this club needs, how much do you know about Gerhard Struber and how much might this match what the Red Bulls are looking for?
Yeah, I don't know a ton. I haven't seen a ton of his teams playing. I did ask some friends who are intimately familiar with the championship, and they all
intimately familiar with the championship. Yes. That's a
some of them work for championship clubs.
There you go. Okay, all right.
And to a person, they were super high on this guy. Just, they felt like he completely turned that team around, saved them from relegation with a little help from Wigan getting docked, and. You know, you look at that and then you look at his background. He's from the Red Bull system. He was a youth team manager, I think, in Salzburg for a while. I think that this is very clearly them saying, okay, we want to have one of our guys in here. And to be fair to Bradley Carnell, they've played a lot better over the past couple of weeks with Bradley Carnell in. It looked like Red Bull soccer in this win over Montreal. I assume that that's what Struber will be going for. And the other thing I assume is Jesse Marsh has proved the path. We talk about the pathway for players all the time, like what it means for MLS players. If Alphonso Davies is at Bayern Munich or Tyler Adams is at RB Leipzig, it gives the next generation of players who might want to move to the biggest clubs in Europe some credibility to think about doing that. And those clubs, the interest in going to MLS. Well, Jesse Marsh has moved from Red Bull New York to RB Salzburg. And Jesse Marsh is not going to stay at RB Salzburg forever. His next move is probably going to be to a Bundesliga team or maybe an English team. And when that job opens up, my guess is that Bradley Struber wants to be like, look what I just did for 2 years with New York. You know, I got us back on top. That's the path that he wants to take, is what I'm guessing. And I'm also guessing that once Struber gets there, the team will look a lot more like what Marsh's team did from 15 to 18, but especially in 17 and 18.
I truly enjoyed that analysis.
Can I add one more thing on this guy?
Sure. Yeah.
I've never heard of him. I'd like to reserve my judgment.
Perfect. Perfect. Same here. But I did like how Doyle combined Bradley Carnell and Gerhard Struber into Bradley Struber there at the very end.
Is that what I did?
The names are just mixing together. All right. Let's talk to Chris Aduyachim here. It's Kick Childhood Cancer Month almost over. Chris, of course, fought his own battle with cancer. We're happy to have him on the show. It's an AT&T 5G call to the field. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah, man. We've been pushing the messages of hope all month, trying to get people out there to help raise money. But this is so much more personal for you. And I know that this league for me is one that I'm constantly in and reading about and experiencing. But I don't think I've ever heard from you in your words what happened to you in October 2018 and all the way until today. You've battled this disease. You've come out on the right side. Tell us about what happened and what you've learned.
Yeah, so my story pretty much started dealing with cancer way before I was diagnosed. Like you said, I was diagnosed around September 2018, but I was dealing with different symptoms and complications pretty much that whole year, 2018. Just couldn't play at my best ability, having breathing problems, couldn't get fit, just a whole bunch of things. I had itching all over my body, weird symptoms and things like that. And it eventually got to a point around August of that year where, you know, I just told my team, I was like, I can't continue playing. I got to really figure out what's wrong with me. I went through a whole bunch of tests, pulmonary, cardiovascular, a whole bunch of different blood tests, things like that. And everything was coming back negative or normal. And that was hard for me because I knew something was wrong with my body. You know, being a soccer player, I'm really in tune with my body. And I just knew something was off. And to be told constantly that that was normal, that was hard for me. And, you know, it was getting later in that season. And at that point, just not being able to know what was wrong with me, you know, I was ready to give up playing. I didn't want to go through another year like that. So, you know, I was trying to go through that, kind of accepting that, you know, this might be it with my playing career since I'm not able to find out what's wrong with me. Until one morning, you know, before practice, I woke up with chest pain and some shortness of breath. And, you know, I told my mom, she made me go to the emergency healthcare room. And, you know, I met the doctor there, ran through some tests, and eventually, you know, it showed he found the tumor in the middle of my chest. And then I had to go through a couple biopsies to figure out what type of cancer I had and how bad it was, and it ended up being stage 2 Hodgkin's lymphoma. And, you know, getting cancer wasn't the great news, but for me, just getting news that I found out eventually, you know, what was wrong with me, that was good for me. And that was a relief for me. I tell people all the time, that was a big relief, actually getting diagnosed with cancer, because I finally figured out what was wrong with me. And there was a treatment plan in place to get me back to where I could possibly be. So, you know, it was a relief for me, and went through the treatment, 4 months of chemotherapy. I had one treatment every other Monday for 4 months, so 8 total treatments. And, you know, I finished my last treatment January 28th. And, you know, just right then, I tried to work my way back to the soccer field, and was able to get back on the field for DC United in May of that year. So,
I mean, it's incredible what you've done. And I, you know, you look at your career and you have that lull in the middle that comes with, God, what's wrong with me? What am I going to do? And then the treatments, you've almost set a career record in this weird, crazy year that we're in, for minutes, for starts, for games played. But before we get to the on-field side, I just want to go back, because as we talk about, you know, the burden, let's say, for children who are diagnosed and their families, I think that the mental side, you know, and this is me guessing, the mental side, just as much as the physical, has to be so difficult. What did you go through during your diagnosis and your treatment? I know your brother was there for you. You've called him out so many times saying without him, he came back from Ghana to be with you, you might not have been able to get through it. Like, how did you deal with the mental side of all this?
Yeah, mentally, just getting advice from several different people. And the main advice that I got was just staying positive, because, you know, the mental battle's half the battle as long as the physical side. So, you know, your colleague, Charlie Davies, reached out to me, and knowing his story and him telling me what I should be looking out for and things like that, that meant a lot for me. Also, Sebastian Salazar, who battled something similar or the same thing when he was younger, and just told me what to expect and how to prepare for it, how to prepare for chemo treatments and things like that. And just seeing other stories of, you know, other athletes in the NFL, there was James Conner, Eric Berry, who went through the same disease I had and was able to make it back to the top of their game. So for me, just seeing them and hearing their stories and talking to them, that just meant a lot for me. And that helped me mentally, saying that I could get back to where I want to be on the soccer field and in life in general. So, yeah, you know, just having, I will also say having a strong support system goes a long way. As you mentioned, my brother, he came to be with me throughout my whole 4 months of chemotherapy. Actually, my first treatment, he flew in from Ghana that morning. And as soon as he arrived to my house, we went straight to the hospital to do my first chemotherapy treatment. He was with me for every treatment. But, you know, I had my parents supporting me, family, friends. I had, you know, my club, DC United, supporting me. And, you know, they're right here in my area. So anything I needed, you know, they were closely accessible. And, you know, I just had a lot of support, a lot of well wishes, and that meant a lot. And my big thing now is that, you know, I'm a professional soccer player. So when I'm diagnosed, you know, a lot of people are reaching out and showing me their support. But, you know, these kids who are diagnosed or going through cancer themselves, they're not getting that type of support, you know. And my message to them is that people do care, and I'm glad that MLS and MLS works and Continental Tires are coming together. And they had this great plan with these messages of hope and people sending their messages to these kids, because I think that goes a long way. And, you know, so.
What are the messages? I mean, look, Charlie Davies is one of the most relentlessly positive people I've ever met. Like, the dude is just contagious. When you think about talking to a kid, seeing a kid, being around kids, having an opportunity to share your story. Is it just that aspect of positivity? I mean, what would you say to kids and their families who are going through this right now?
Yeah, the main thing is staying positive. And also, like I was saying, leaning on your support system. You have people who are there for you, your family, your friends, parents, for these kids. And, you know, for me, I was a pretty prideful person at the time. So, you know, I didn't want to ask for help or anything like that. But cancer is a battle that you can't go through alone. And there's going to be days where you're going to have to lean on others. And that's why your support system is there, you know, to be strong for you, and days where you can't really be too strong for yourself. So those are my main messages that I give to these kids when I speak to them.
What does it mean now to you when you step on the field? Has it changed the way you look at soccer?
Yeah, going through this battle has changed not only how I play soccer, but also, you know, just my life and my perspective in life has totally shifted and for the better. So, you know, now that I look back at my cancer and my journey, you know, I don't really look at it as a negative. I just see it as something that I went through and I had to go through in order to grow. And now I have the perspective in life that anything that doesn't really go my way or the way I thought it would go, it's just a way for me to grow, you know. For instance, if I make a mistake, I don't get down on myself about it. I just look at it as, okay, I made this mistake, and how can I learn from it to not make a bigger mistake in the future? So that's my perspective in life now. And it works for me, you know, and it's been good for me so far.
Well, Chris, I just want to say thank you for joining us, sharing your story. It's inspirational. It's awesome to see you on the field again. It's even better to see you healthy and looking at life with such a positive lens. Before you let you go, anything that you want to say, anything you want to share with folks out there?
No, I just want to thank you for allowing me on your platform so I can share my story and reach other people and raise awareness to people that I probably wouldn't have reached before. So thank you for allowing me on the show today.
It's my pleasure, man. Tom Bogert wrote a great feature at MLSsoccer.com back in 2019. You can go read that. Chris Adriachim. Huge thanks to Chris for sharing his story here with us. Remember, you can use the hashtag KickChildhoodCancer. $25 every time you do. Send a message of hope to kids that are battling this disease. Goes to the Children's Oncology Group from Continental Tire. Thanks again for Continental letting us be a part of this push this month. Some news around MLS. Stephen Goff, The Washington Post, reports that Ben Olsen is on the hot seat in D.C. Basically, Ben's not on the hot seat, said one person. He's on a scalding hot seat. I don't know what that means. It's been a long time at D.C. for Ben Olsen, but the results clearly are not there. We'll have to see what happens. You can reread that reporting at the Washington Post. Let's go to the mailbag. Levi from La Grande, Oregon. Just listen to the first installment of the Movement podcast. So good. Looking forward to more.
Who said this?
This is Levi from La Grande, Levi. Oregon. Yes.
Shout out to Levi. Thanks for listening. No, actually, I got a bunch of feedback and reports from people that had looked at releasing it through the Extra Time feed, and we had a ton of downloads and a ton of people. You can tell you can listen all the way through. So I want to thank everybody who's really supported and sent messages and share it with your friends and all that. And yes, there will be more. I got to get back to work, I guess.
Yeah, The Movement. Go search it on iTunes. Go subscribe so that whenever it does come, you've got it right there ready for you. Cameron Chittick says, when LAFC sold Walker Zimmerman, the general consensus was it was a price where they couldn't say no. As we now sit below the playoff line, are we still so sure about that? It reminds me of Sporting KC selling Ike. Do teams just undervalue defenders? That's $1.25 million they got for Walker. It doesn't sound as good if LAFC missed the playoffs. Same for Betisher walking as well. What have we learned about those two deals? And is it, hey, if you have a best 11 center back, you just like get your claws in him and don't ever let him go?
Yeah, same with LGP. You know, Atlanta, if you could ask Atlanta if they want to do that one over again, they absolutely would. I think that Nashville did a very smart thing. As soon as they got Walker there, they signed him to a 5-year extension. If you have a best 11 MLS center back and he, you know, he's in his prime and he doesn't, you know, he's not looking to make a move overseas, you sign him for as long as you can, because going out on the international market and looking for a Walker Zimmerman replacement costs a lot more than $1 million. It just does at this point, and we need to start appropriately valuing the guys who prove themselves in MLS. Should have learned it when
Columbus let Chad Marshall walk. Should have learned it, you know, before last year when Sporting let Ike walk. And now everybody has to learn from LAFC's and Atlanta's misfortune with Walker Zimmerman and LGP, because those guys have not been adequately replaced, and it's going to take a lot of money to do it.
I think of a guy like Matt Hedges that FC Dallas basically just said, hey, you're ours and we're never letting you go. Like, he may not be at a level of like an Ike Opara in his prime or a Chad Marshall, but the level of consistency and the floor that you establish and sort of the ability to build off whatever it is that guy does, I mean, it absolutely changes your team. Asa and Stubbtown.
Let me real quick. It's also why I haven't crushed Nashville for passing on Daryl DK with the second pick in the draft, because they saw in Jack Marr, they saw a young center back who they felt is that level. Now, they haven't gotten him any playing time, and 2020 has ruined a lot of things. But I think that also, if you're looking in the draft and you see someone who projects to be a Hedges or a Zimmerman, like, that's the pick you make. So I do think that Nashville actually played that one right.
Asa and Stumptown, can you guys please explain why it's important that the Canadian clubs have games where they're designated the home club? I see the advantage in baseball, but not soccer. He's probably talking about the Vancouver Whitecaps being the home team at Providence Park against the Portland Timbers. It's just a bizarre 2020 thing, man. It only makes sense in these circumstances, in this fantasy land that we live in right now. So Asa, I wouldn't worry about it too much, man. There's no fans in the stands. Doesn't matter that much. Ryan in Toronto. Hey guys, I'm wondering what your Canada 11
now. Would that hold true for the playoffs, or we don't know yet?
Oh, that's a good point. I cannot see a circumstance in which playoff games would be played in Canada. I mean, and that's just me speculating. But I think
so. In that case, if you're like Vancouver and you get in as the, like, you know.
Let's go more realistic. Come on. You're Toronto FC, you're playing at Rentschler Field. This is everything that Doyle's ever dreamed of. Playoff soccer at Rentschler.
But it goes more to my thinking of just how, I don't know, meaningless the playoff seating system is going to be this year. I mean, there's some travel involved, but other than that, without home field, without actual fans in stadiums for the most part, and without, in some cases, with people playing in different arenas altogether. I don't know. It feels like if you're LAFC, you're like, all right, well, whatever. We'll see what happens. We want to get on the right track, but as long as you get in and then you start playing at the right time, it sounds like a dynamo move. I like it.
Yeah. Look, I just like the idea that the MLS Cup goes through Rentschler. That theory, that concept alone is everything to me. Let's see. Last one here before we get out of here, guys. Nick from Honolulu. Oh, actually, Ryan in Toronto. I almost skipped it. He probably would have been furious at me, the Canadians.
No, skip it till next week, because I don't have a good answer.
Okay,
yet.
You don't have your Canada 11 off the top of your head?
I have the Canada 11. Okay. Well, I mean, they have really big questions to ask, because Alphonso Davies, as great as he is at left back for Bayern Munich, has been terrible at left back for Canada. So they have to figure that one out. I have to figure it out.
I saw one here asking me if I ever missed a flight. I don't know.
Oh, like that, yeah. But. Yeah, I forgot that one. So RSL drew Minnesota, and I didn't want to talk about this match because it was not a great match. And Corey Baird would have been helpful for RSL, but he missed the flight. He was apparently late to the team flight and missed it. Kaylin, have you ever come close to missing a flight as a professional? Have you missed a flight? Has it happened in a team that you were on? Will you admit it publicly if it had?
Not on the way to a match.
Well, yeah, come on, but that's understandable. You get a big dub, you got to go out, like, you know, you the next one, day up anyway.
No, I never missed one on the way back, but there was a couple close. Visiting New York, there was a close one once. It was quick cab ride. I think CJ Brown had my bag ready for me. I appreciate it. Shout out to CJ for
Just run through the hotel.
I was young. Yeah. I know better now.
Different
but
times.
But no, not to a match. But yeah, whew, that'd be stressful.
I'm a late arriver.
Battle traffic.
Late arriver at the airport, and I've had a number of instances where I have, like, you know, like, slid into home and barely been safe, and had them closing the blast door or whatever it is, and let me through. Corey Baird, not so lucky on this one. Okay, this one's the last one. Nick from Honolulu. Hey guys, you rock. I saw Doyle's U.S. national team top 11, mostly agreed. One glaring disagreement. Why did you choose Matt Turner over Zach Steffen? Steffen, one of the best goalkeepers in the Bundesliga last year when he wasn't injured, and now number two at one of the best clubs in the world by one of the best managers in the world in one of the best leagues in the world. So Doyle, this is basically just your opportunity to clarify Matt Turner over Zach Stefan.
Or apologize.
So then I'm not going to apologize. So I think it's very overstated to say that Stefan was one of the best goalkeepers in the Bundesliga last year. By the numbers, he was one of the worst shot stoppers in the entire Bundesliga. And by the numbers in MLS, he was a below average shot stopper, except for penalties where he's like God level. In the run of play, he has been poor at the number one job of goalkeepers, which is to keep the ball out of the back of the net. His feet are excellent. I think he commands the box better, a little bit better than Turner does. Turner's feet are still really good. His command of the box needs to improve. In terms of shot stopping, he, over the course of 50 games, he's maybe the best I've ever seen in MLS. First 50 games that he has played. People were really upset about that analysis. And what's going to happen is, Matt Turner is going to move to a Bundesliga club or maybe even an EPL club because he has an EU passport. And a year from now, we're going to hear, oh, man, he's improved so much since moving to Europe. And that is going to be wrong because he is already this good. And if you look at their numbers, limited just to MLS, Turner has been miles beyond what Stefan was able to do in MLS, just in terms of keeping the ball out of the back of the net. And I'm a little old fashioned. To me, that is the number one thing that I care about with my goalkeepers.
Brilliant.
I'm all about bigging them up. But like Zach Stefan to me is, I mean, he is where he is for a reason. And when you watch the experience of that, you know, beating France in France, I believe it was, or in Europe, and some of the performances that he's put in already for a young goalkeeper for the U.S. men's national team, I'm like, and even when I watched him play with City the other day, I'm like, that feels good. Like I put him when I look through the list of players, and we've all had a lot to be excited about lately. I was like, I bet Stefan's going to get a game soon for Man City, and then next thing I know, I was like, I wonder when that will happen. But then he gets one and does quite well, and I was like, all right, well, here we go.
His footwork on that goal was not great. And that's the thing with Stefan in his shot stopping. He has a really high stance, and because of that, he doesn't get a good push. So he needs to have like a little bit wider stance, and he needs to be a little bit better in his positioning as well. And I think if he does that, then we're talking about a guy who can become one of the best goalkeepers in the world. And my hope is that Manchester City work on that, because the entirety of Stefan's shot stopping struggles for me come from his pretty sloppy footwork.
Look, it's just a shame that the U.S. national team is not able to be together in a grand sense, to see Matt Turner have his opportunity, to see those two compete, to see what Greg Berhalter thinks in person, to have all these guys just together. It's one of the shames of 2020, of many, many shames. That's it for us. Big thanks to Tom Boger for joining us, Chris Adriachim as well. Remember, use the hashtag #KickChildhoodCancer. We're out of here. I'm gone on Thursday, on to vacation, to many a park, Kaylin. Oh. I'll send you some photos, give you some updates on that. It's a thrilling life that I lead. Dave will be back. Dude. Charlie will be here. We'll see you then. Have a great week, everybody. We'll be right back.